Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Childhood was a continual nightmare for Leslie Radatz. To survive, she repressed all her memories of neglect and abuse until one day, at 34 years old, they resurfaced with a vengeance. Leslie was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, characterized by flashbacks, nightmares, the inability to sleep, hyperarousal, and body memories. Leslie is here today to tell her story in the hopes it will help others to get the help they need to deal with trauma. Her book, Flashbacks and Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, is available on our website or through Amazon. Leslie, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Why did you write the book? What did you want people to know?
I wrote the book because I felt everything that I learned so far, that it was a book like mine to outline what my trauma was about and to show me the way to heal. If I had a book like that, I think I would have gotten help sooner. It started out with panic attacks and hyper alert, feeling alone, afraid to be alone. So I felt if I could just get a hold of those people that were not being treated, that it would help them to get treated sooner than I did.
Your childhood was wrought with abuse and parental neglect. How did that shape your world as a young girl?
Well, I learned to do what I was told and not to listen to, like, intuition or, you know, the intuition that tells you to run or to get away from, you know, the bad people. The adults in my life gave me some false feeling of safety when it came to my uncle's abuse, my great-uncle's abuse. They would wave me on to say goodbye to him, and then the long goodbyes would start, and that was with inappropriate touching and kissing on our mouths, and that happened to all three of my sisters and myself.
What were some of the ways that you were neglected as a child by your parents?
Well, we didn't have enough food a lot of the times. We had what was called feast and famine. My mom and dad would get, you know, food stamps. We were in welfare. My mom was a dried alcoholic at that point, but she still had addictions to cigarettes and soda and things that she wanted. So she would buy a bunch of junk food the first two weeks out of the month, where we would have suppers and a lot of junk food like soda and chips and things to make up for the last 2 weeks of the month, where we would be lucky if we had a piece of bread with mayo or a piece of bread with syrup on it. And that's one of the reasons why I started getting abused by my friend's brother, and having to witness my friend's dad abuse her was because I went to their house knowing that if I did what they wanted me to do, they would feed me.
Hmm.
The other thing is, we would run out of toilet paper and pads, and we would have to resort to using paper bags, wash rags, bath towels, and kitchen towels. And then they would be put back into the dirty wash where they would be washed and used again for bathing and dishes.
Did your parents work at all?
Yes, my mom didn't work a lot of my childhood. She had she was disabled, her back. She's also very dyslexic, and so she would have cleaning jobs for, you know, probably a month or two, and then her back wouldn't be able to handle the pain, and she'd quit. My father, when I was in that small town until I was five. My dad was a painter, and then on the weekends he was he played in a band in the bars and for weddings and things.
So you grew up around that scene?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay to bring children into a bar.
Well, were your parents loving toward you, or were they just detached?
They were detached in my early years, but in my, you know, adult years, where after, I think after the pressure of not having to rear me, then we became closer.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought my life was normal with them until 12 years ago when I met my husband. He's like, Leslie, you got to make a choice. How you're living and what you're doing is just not right. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, we go after work, you take the kids to your mom and dad's, we hang out, we talk to them, we eat supper with them, and then we go home at 8 o'clock to our house. He's like, you gotta break away from them, you know. And so he kind of came from a really good family, so he was able to see the dysfunction and how my dad would enable my mom.
Hmm.
So he kind of pulled me away a little bit.
Did you get messages from your childhood that you couldn't cut it, you were inadequate, you weren't good enough?
I just felt, I felt like my mom was a big yeller. So we were always in the way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
From 3 years old on, I was pretty much watching myself. My mom would get to the point where, you know, kids run in and out of the house. There was four of us, and we were pretty close in age. She would lock us outside with no jacket in the middle of winter and not think a second guess on it. Mm. And so I would always be searching for my sisters because they would run faster than I could. And that would leave me in this small town, just this little three-year-old walking around town trying to find, you know, my sisters or anybody. Opened me up to a lot of trauma because this one boy didn't like my sister and he was mad at her. He took a big rock and smashed it over my head.
I got
my head bleeding and it was really huge.
So you grew up being afraid. I mean, constantly there was this low-grade fear for you because you weren't taken care of.
Right. It was always, you know.
Did you feel safe in your home?
No.
No.
My dad had PTSD when he came, he was in Vietnam War. After he had all the children, the PTSD started, and he would pull knives on my mom, and I witnessed it at 4 years old.
How did you handle that? I mean, that must have been terrifying for you.
Well, for me, I repressed all these memories for 32 years, and my life came crashing down last year. March of 2011, when I started getting counseling, and the EMDR and brain spotting therapy they used, rather than it coming out slowly, the whole thing came flooding.
Mm-hmm.
So I had flooding in my brain, and I ended up in the hospital because of one of those memories.
Mm.
Really scared me.
So the flashback started first. Did the body memory start first, or did the flashback start first?
I would say the body memories did.
And can you talk about that so folks will kind of know what that's about?
Yeah. Body memories, it's with no picture, all of a sudden you can have the feelings of your trauma, such as I was in a fire. When I was a kid, I played with matches with my sister, and we were involved in starting a fire in the house. I was so intimidated by my Uncle Ned because he was a really scary man. He took us upstairs to this burning, you know, this smoldering framework, you know, after the fire was put out. It was still hot.
Mm-hmm.
And he screamed at us so severe that I started having this body memory where I would get really scared and my stomach would hurt really bad. And it would happen for like 17 hours. My stomach would be in so much pain, I'd end up in the ER.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up that if I throw up, then my body would go back to normal.
Yeah, you release the tension, the stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's one body memory example. Another one is when you have PTSD, you have sensitivity to smell. And I would feel like I could smell my rapist in the house. when he's not even here.
Mm-hmm.
I would be sensitive to repeating words or loud words. I think the repeating words was my great uncle when he would abuse us. He would say woo 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 in our ears, really loud. And so I think that's where that comes from. The loudness, I think, comes from my mom just constantly screaming at us, my dad, because he would get, you know, overly angry and overly discipline us.
So when all this happened as a little girl, you just kind of emotionally withdrew. You pull all of that stuff inward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were there any warning signs when all this began for you with the flashbacks? Were you under more stress than usual? What do you think caused that to happen at that particular time in your life?
Well, my daughters started triggering me. They got into some trouble. They started telling me that they were being bullied at school, and that triggered me because I was bullied also, you know, four eyes, and I had an accident where I had scarring on my face. So the kids were very horrible. So I got involved in the school trying to figure out this bullying thing. I found out that my ex-husband was neglecting to supervise them on the weekends, and they ended up going to a friend's house and no supervision and playing this nervous game with a group of kids. The nervous game is kind of equivalent to the dare game, but it gets sexual. Ultimately, you get comfortable with each other, and everyone's having touching and having intercourse with each other, boys on boys, girls on girls, boys and girls, you know.
Yeah.
And so that triggered me. And so when the court said, all of you are being charged with sexual assault of a child because you're all under the age of 18, and there was a fourth grader involved, they had to have probation and counseling. So I decided to get counseling at that time because I could feel things that weren't right with me. I couldn't sleep at night. I constantly was had rapid thoughts going through my head and constant being scared to be alone, you know.
And you had panic attacks? You were having panic attacks at this point?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my husband would leave, you know, and I didn't want to tell him, you know, because like I said, I thought I was going crazy. I didn't want to be put away. And he would leave for a day or two to go up north and be with his brother. And I literally would stay up 2 days straight, sitting in my bed, scared that someone's going to come in and rape me again or try to rape my children. I would have escape routes already mapped out in my head, what I could use in the room to defend myself. It was really scary, you know.
Terrifying.
Yeah, very traumatizing, and the adrenaline would be pumping through. I said, you know, if anyone would have broken into my house, I'd feel very bad for them because I was waiting for, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I would have killed somebody. And and thank God, you know, my husband didn't softly come in the house because he could have got hurt, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So did the counselor teach you anything to, obviously she did, to move out of the shutdown mode? Because that's what happens. And we give people exercises to help them move out of this shutdown mode. Were there things that she taught you to help you connect to your body again?
Yeah, she, like I said, we did the EMDR and the brain spotting to help with the trauma.
Can you explain EMDR for folks that don't know that?
Sure. EMDR is eye movement sensitization reprocessing. What that is they put headsets on my head and they have music, soft music playing with two tones they call bilateral tones that bounce off of my brain and stimulates memories. The brain spotting is where they find a focal point of where I'm most calm. And they're able to find that a certain trauma, and then we start working on it.
So in other words, they're wanting you to ground yourself somehow. Because we teach people how to ground themselves by, say, imagining a safe place. And sometimes I'll spend lots of time with clients just having them articulate just to the T of this safe place that they're going to go to. What color is the sky? Is the weather nice? Can you feel the sand? What does it feel like if it's a beach scene? Just really having them identify this safe place so that when the trauma work gets too intense that they can go back to that place.
Yes, that. And she also has me find like a resource person, whether it's my adult self or whether it's God or an angel holding the child. People don't realize that when people have trauma, they have what's called ECHO states. And for me, that would be the 3-year, the 4-year-old, the 14-year-old that got raped. We never know which ECHO state's going to step forward to talk about what happened to her. And it's weird because when you're under that therapy, it's like the ECHO state could be like 3 years old, but then also your adult self is present, like looking in. But your child is going through the trauma all over again, feeling the feelings I felt, seeing the images, flashbacking to, you know, my house, the fire, always being injured. And that was the only time I felt loved by my mom, is when I was injured to the point of having to get to the hospital quick before the blood loss, you know. I ended up running into a barbed wire fence when I was 5, and my tongue was half hanging, and my my nose was all cut. We lived about 30 to 45 minutes away from the hospital in this small town where we lived, and up north. And it was always something so traumatic like that, because I had no supervision, you know. And if I did have supervision, it was my sisters playing rough, you know, or really not watching me.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a lot of fear there, and fear in dealing with the trauma. And the fear becomes immobilizing. And so you're in a constant state of hyperarousal. You know, it's a signal to the brain that there's danger, even when there isn't.
Right.
So it's always you know, it's the child and then the adult self looking back into that.
Yeah.
And you're constantly being terrorized. It's kind of like a cat and a mouse. You know how a cat catches a mouse and terrorizes it by pawing at it, and the mouse is continually experiencing a reactivation of terror and going deeper and deeper into a state of immobility. And then when it finally revives itself, you know, it displays this incredible burst of energy to escape. And trauma sufferers do the same thing by re-terrorizing themselves with misplaced fear about their own bodily sensations and emotions. And sometimes when they come out of that fear, they're often agitated and angry. Did that ever happen to you?
Yeah, that's actually another reason why I got help, was because I got to the point where I would be at a certain level of feeling stressed out, you know, and it was like the top of the top. And then my children would do something simple like a teenage child would do, and then I would start yelling, you know. And my husband's like, hey, it really wasn't that bad. Why are you yelling, you know? Or they would have their music turned up, you know, to a PTS person. We got sensitive hearing, so they might have it at a regular level, but to me it was banging loud, and I would just close my, put my hands over my ears and start screaming, just turn it down,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I was talking to a friend this morning, actually, whose husband was in Vietnam, and he, to this day, has sensitivity to loud noises. She said it took years for him to be able to even go out on the 4th of July and hear fireworks.
Wow.
So it's that sensitivity to loud noises or startle response, over-exaggerated startle response.
And then I had to learn how to comfort the child within. That was one of the relaxation things they taught me. I never knew that there was another child inside, you know.
And so what are some skill sets you learned to do that, like muscle relaxation, deep breathing, things like that?
Yeah, they have a CD, an EMDR CD called Letting Go. And I used it last night, actually, for the first time. And it helps to relax your body, and there's like 10 different points. And by the end of the CD, I don't even remember it stopping. I was sleeping. I was in a deep sleep for finally, you know. And usually, you know, I would, you know, stay up at night worrying about work, you know, worrying about the kids, and just would never sleep.
Yeah.
And so that's really helpful.
Helpful tool.
And then for trauma, when I would have like a crisis or something would trigger me, they did what was called, showed me how to do a safe bag. And in the safe bag, it has, you know, exercises, breathing exercises, things that comfort me, like maybe a candle for bath time, and lotions that smell good, you know. It'll be different for everybody, you know, but it really helped me when I needed it.
Sure, and helps to bring down that emotional affect to, you know, stability rather than, you know, total panic. your counselor do any other trauma work with you that you can share?
Well, we do nurturing trauma. And that was where the in the beginning they did that to help me to get to the connected to the child within, where they have you go back and picture yourself in a bassinet as a baby, and you know how you hold the baby and how they do imagery to take you to the safe place, mm-hmm. and feed the baby and take care of all its needs, because I didn't have my needs taken care of. Mm-hmm. So they kind of try to get that inside of me so I can start, you know, feeling better, you know, the child within feeling better. It's like my adult self is being a parent to my child within, so that my child within can integrate back into the adult, mm-hmm. so that I stay more adult more of the time, because I didn't know it, but I was mostly a child, you know, when I first started doing any therapy. I would catch myself trying to rationalize with my five-year-old that's having a tantrum, and I'd be at his same level, you know?
Yeah.
And so it affected my parenting really bad, you know?
Sure, because no parenting skills were ever modeled for you.
Yeah.
You were never nurtured. You never attached to your mother because she was disengaged. So there's all those attachment, you know, issues and loss of attachment bonds to boot. Besides the PSD, you were diagnosed with conversion disorder and somatization disorder. Can you explain that for folks who've never heard of that?
Oh, sure. Because I repressed my memories for 32 years, you know, that puts a lot of stress on your body. And what conversion disorder does is, in order to protect my mind from me really going crazy, having a nervous breakdown, it would start attacking my body. So to relieve that stress. So an example of that would be when my son was 15 months old, I had a stabbing pain in my eye, and I was at Walmart, and I had to go in and get a sandwich to eat. You know, I had migraines all the time, so I figured, oh, it's another migraine. When I got time to get up there and ask what I wanted, you know, on my sandwich and everything, I couldn't speak. And I was like, and this lady is like, oh, it's okay, you know, just tell me what you need, and thought that I was challenged, you know, and I was embarrassed, and I went and sat down. I ended up having all the symptoms of a stroke, and that's the conversion part. Your body just shuts down because it needs rest. I ended up I did not know who my husband was. I didn't know the president of the United States. I didn't know any of the simple information I should know. And I got scared because the top of my head and hands went numb. And I went to go get the girl, and I noticed I could speak again. And I went and said, you gotta sit with me. Something's wrong with me. And then as we were sitting there, I looked at this little boy and I said, you know, he's been sitting there an awful long time. I don't know where his mom is. And this lady just looked at me in a shocked look, and she said, you walked in with him.
Wow.
And he was 15 months old. And that's when she called 911. She goes, I think it's time to call 911. And I couldn't tell her who I was, but I knew enough to give her my driver's license. And when I looked down at my driver's license, I couldn't read it. And so they, you know, got me to the hospital, called my husband, and I didn't even know who my husband was.
Mm.
And that was scary.
Sure.
And so the somatization part of all of this is I had all the symptoms of a stroke that a stroke victim would have without the permanent damage. But the somatization thing is, the doctors did all the tests consistent with a stroke victim, and it all came back normal.
Mm.
So they don't find nothing wrong with me. It's strange.
Yeah. It's like it affects you neurologically, the whole conversion thing. Shame feeds into the misperception of traumatized people who believe they're somehow responsible or the cause of or deserving of the things that happened. How did you deal with shame? Because that's a huge piece.
It was really hard, you know. I was ashamed that I participated, you know, in what my friend's brother and she was doing. in order to survive, I knew she'd feed me. Mm-hmm. So in order to survive, it was strange because we'd be playing in her room, let's say, and her brother would, bang in the door and, start tearing our Barbie dolls' heads off, and there was fear there, mm-hmm. And then, the first time they brought me down to the basement, the mother was gone, and he was laying on a table with his face covered. He didn't say a word. It was like a ritual thing. She knew mm-hmm. what was to be done.
Yeah.
He didn't say a word. He didn't threaten me, but the threat was when he would come into that room, he was scary and pushing us and ripping our dresses mm-hmm. and our Barbie dolls. After we would do whatever it was he wanted, he must have spoke to her or whatever, because it would be different every time. Mm-hmm. It was weird because she would have like a glass like look on her face, and then she would return back to my friend, and we'd walk back upstairs, and he would let us play the rest of the day, and we could be little girls.
Mm.
That was hard for me.
Yeah.
That I had shame because no one threatened me. I felt like it was my fault.
Yeah, sure.
Because no one, held a knife to me. I did what I was told, regardless of what my intuition was telling me, in order to be fed and taken care of, mm-hmm.
Leslie, I could talk, for another hour about this with you. Unfortunately, we're out of time. How can folks get your book?
They can go to www.silencednolonger.com. That's my website. They also can get it on www.amazon.com. In Oshkosh, Wisconsin, it's already in Paper Tiger and Apple Blossom bookstores. And Barnes & Noble also has it on their website.
Yeah, we've got it on our website, too. So,
yeah.
Boy, thank you so much for your willingness to just tell your story. And I know it's just going to touch lots and lots of lives and just provide help and healing for so many people, Leslie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time today to be our guest.
Thank you.
Okay, God bless.
God bless.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at siftedaswheat.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.